as a general class and figure out how we write down the condition of force free on the free functions we come up with, and also interpret those functions physically. One of them will be what's called the magnetic flux function, or sometimes the stream function. And I'll also introduce the general idea, the idea that generalizes the light surface, and explain why it's really a crucial concept for these stationary axisymmetric configurations. But just to say generally, configurations with symmetry. And let's just say, what do I mean? Configurations of what? At this point, I'm only talking about degenerate fields, not force-free. So this also applies to any degenerate field. So for degenerate F, so remember that implies that F is a simple two-form, and it can be written as the wedge product of differentials of a pair of Euler potentials. So the question really becomes, if F has a symmetry or multiple symmetries, what does that tell us about the Euler potentials? What can we do to implement the symmetries by choosing special forms of the potentials? And what I'll explain, I'm not going to go through the derivation, but it's in our Appendix D. It's basically, I just went through Uchida's paper. He has figured it all out, but it's a very, very long, complicated, long-winded thing. And I just used differential forms technology and just made it much simpler. But it's exactly his argument. So the conclusion of the argument is the following. If you have one symmetry, so by which I mean, let's say there's some killing vector X for the field. So I'm just talking about symmetries of the field at this point, not of the space-time. I guess you could possibly have a situation where the field had a symmetry the space-time didn't have, maybe. Anyway, just I'm only talking about a vector field X such that the Lie derivative of F with respect to X is 0. And, you know, by this Cartan formula, this we can write this as X dF, X into dF plus d of X into F. And dF is 0 because F is a closed two-form by Maxwell's equation. So really, this can also be written this way, which I point out just because the classification depends on whether or not X dot F is 0. So if X dot F is 0, that means that the killing vector of the field, the symmetry vector, is in the kernel of F. So it's tangent to the field sheet. So that's one case, and where it's not is another case. If it is tangent to F, then it's quite trivial, because then just taking X dot and into this, you get X dot this times this minus X dotted into this times this. But if that vanishes because these two forms are independent, that implies that both of those dot products vanish. And therefore, phi 1 and phi 2 are both constant along X. So I'm just saying X dot F equals, this is just to give you a flavor of what goes into it. It's X dot dx d phi 1 d phi 2 minus X dot d phi 2 d phi 1 d phi 1. These are linearly independent one forms because if they're not, F is just 0. So if we say that this is 0, that tells us that both of these coefficients vanish. But that says that the function phi 1 is constant along the flow of X, and the same thing for phi 2. But that means you can just take the potentials to be independent. If you have coordinates in which your killing vector is just the coordinate derivative along some coordinate, then your potentials are independent of that ignorable coordinate. So that's the simplest case. But it's not generally going to be the case. Now, it gets more complicated when we have two symmetries, and that's the case we're most interested in, like stationary axisymmetry or a pair of let's say we could do a planar model that's got time dependence, or we could have cylindrical symmetry and time dependence, or maybe just helical symmetry plus time translation. There are all kinds of interesting special cases that fall into having two killing vectors that commute.
I mean, doesn't this relation say that the kernel vectors are always a symmetry of F? Or am I missing something?
If you take a vector field made of kernel vectors, this will be zero. Yeah.
Okay, so in general, you always have two symmetries of your.
Should I be surprised by that? No, but yeah, I guess that's where it becomes important whether these are symmetries of the space-time metric also. Because if they're not, then when you, the metric doesn't come into the effect that F is closed, but the other Maxwell equation involves the dual, involves the metric. So I guess it wouldn't be useful, but it's a true statement. That's why I hadn't thought about it. Interesting observation. Okay, so now consider, what if we have two symmetries of F generated by two vectors X and Y? Then it turns out that we get two cases. In one case where F contracted with X and Y both is zero. Or where it's not zero. Let's see. So Uchida called this case one and this case two. This is, turns out to be, at least for stationary axisymmetry, the more interesting case. In this case, some linear combination of X and Y has to be tangent to the field sheets. And in this case, no linear combination is tangent to the field sheets. Just turns out. So I'm not even going to say, let me just give the answer in this case, because it's the one we're going to want. And the answer is this, that the two potentials can be chosen to satisfy x dot d phi 1 is 0. So phi 1 is independent of the x direction, and it's also independent of the y direction. So phi 1 shares all the symmetry that F has. But then you can't also say that phi 2 does. X dot, you can normalize it so x dot d phi 2 is 1. So you can always play around with phi 1 and phi 2 to achieve this. And then there's one more condition. Y dot d phi 2 can be an arbitrary function of phi 1. That's just what comes out of the general analysis. So let's apply it to stationary axisymmetry, where x is, actually, I'm going to say x is d by d phi, and y is d by dt. And then we get that phi 1 can be taken to be an arbitrary function of the other variables. So it's some psi of r and theta. So let's use spherical type coordinates, r theta phi t. And phi translation and t translation are symmetries. So we can choose one potential to just depend on these angles, on these variables. And phi 2 then is some other function also of them, plus the angle itself. And we'll write it as minus, because it turns out what we want for the interpretation, omega f, the field angular velocity, which is a function of psi times t. And what are we saying by choosing case one in this case? It's that the T phi component of F is zero. That says that there's no electric field in the phi direction, which is perfectly appropriate for stationary axisymmetry because I guess this one I like to think about in terms of the 3 plus 1 form of Maxwell's equations. The line if there were a component of electric field along phi, then the line integral of E around that circle in the phi direction would be non-zero. But then by Faraday's law, that would have to be equal to the rate of change of the magnetic flux through that circle. But if the solution is stationary, there can't be any changing flux. Now, strictly mathematically, that's not true. Because you could be like mathematical about it and cut a cylinder out of space-time, and then you could have a magnetic flux threading the cylinder that's not actually in the space. Sort of like the Aharonov-Bohm effect sort of situation. And then you could have that changing in time, even though it's not in the space. In other words, you could write down a solution such that everywhere in the actual space you're talking about, there's only stationary fields and violate this condition, but it would clearly be artificial. So for the purpose of real space that doesn't have holes cut out of it and a stationary solution, this is exactly what we want for the stationary axisymmetric case. So this is it. And we want to interpret this and this in particular. We're not really going to interpret this because it's messy, but we'll interpret something related to it. So the next step is just write down the general field that comes from these. So F is d psi. Wedge d phi 2, which will break up into the two terms that come from this and from the others. And then Sam and I found it convenient to replace d of this to give it a name, because it just carries through the whole calculation. So we called it eta. And in fact, we call it the co-rotation one form, and I'll explain why in a second. So what eta is equal to is just d phi minus omega dt. You might worry about what about when the exterior derivative hits omega, but that's going to bring out d of omega f is equal to omega f prime, where the prime means derivative with respect to its argument, times d psi. But we're wedging this with d psi. So that derivative won't contribute anyway, so we might as well write this in terms of eta this way. Now, I want to introduce terms here, poloidal and toroidal, in a slightly different way than they're usually used. So poloidal and toroidal usually refer to three-dimensional space. I guess the r theta sort of plane at fixed azimuth phi is the poloidal plane. I'll put plane in quotes just because we can do this in a Kerr metric where we wouldn't really call that manifold a plane, but space, maybe I should call it. Let's call it space. And then we've got T phi. Now, usually toroidal is just the phi direction, but it's very natural here to group these into two pairs and include the time in the toroidal space. That way we've just decomposed space-time into a 2 plus 2 decomposition, and we call this the toroidal space. And the reason it's really useful is that the metric the Kerr metric using, if these are Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, is block diagonal so that there are no metric components coupling T phi with R theta. In fact, this is also diagonal by itself, but the important thing is that there's nothing that couples this to this. So we're going to have this decomposition that we constantly make use of space-time into 2 plus 2 form. And let me just say a little bit about that. So the metric has a toroidal and a poloidal piece. You know, the volume element we could write as the toroidal volume element wedge the poloidal volume element. And the dual of the toroidal volume element is the poloidal volume element. Actually, it's minus it. And the dual of the poloidal volume element is plus the toroidal volume element. And there are a bunch of other formulas, but I'll only write one of them that's the most important one for us. Suppose we have a two-form that's the wedge product of a poloidal one-form and a toroidal one-form. And we want to take the dual of that. Then again, remember the geometrical meaning of the dual is that we're supposed to find the two-form, the simple two-form that's orthogonal to this. But I can do that just by doing it in the two pieces of the 2 plus 2. So I dualize omega p in the poloidal space and omega t in the toroidal space. And I need a notation for that dual, so we used a star instead of an asterisk. And I think there's a minus sign that comes. So it just turns out it's minus that dual of omega p wedge that dual of omega t. This is just purely a matter of computational efficiency that we can break up our duals like that. Yeah. So now let's come back to this f and take its dual. You can see that this is a strictly poloidal two-form, and this is a toroidal two-form. The dual of f is the dual of this poloidal form is going to be a toroidal one. Let me just define something I call I. The reason I call it I is it's going to turn out to be current over 2 pi times dt wedge d phi. So that's the dual of this. And then the dual of that is going to be minus the star of d psi wedge the star of theta. And then basically I prefer to use this I instead of this function d psi 2 because it has a simpler interpretation. This isn't our idea. This is what's always done in this field. You can see that actually I has another meaning. It's basically the toroidal component of the magnetic field, although with the wrong scaling factor. It's related by the determinant of the metric. Let me write that down. So usually you'll see defined the toroidal magnetic field as being the same as I over 2 pi. But if you really want the magnitude of the magnetic field in the toroidal direction normalized properly, it's actually 1 over the square root of the toroidal metric. Yeah, I guess I'll explain that here. Uh-oh, I just screwed up. Okay, so let's just use this notation in this line and rewrite f in terms of I by dualizing this back again. We're going to pick up the determinant there. I won't work out the detail, but we just get square root of minus the toroidal determinant times the poloidal volume element plus d psi wedge eta. So this is the nicest form to think about this field in. It has a poloidal piece and a toroidal. The poloidal piece describes the toroidal magnetic field whose proper magnitude is I over 2 pi square root of minus the toroidal determinant. Nevertheless, as I was just saying, the notation B toroidal is generally used for I over 2 pi and not including this determinant. Just to avoid confusion, I'll mention that explicitly. Okay. Another nice formula that we worked out is just what's the square of the field? That tells us whether it's magnetic or electrically dominated. We can just see we square that. The square of the volume element is 2. So we get I over 2 pi squared times minus g toroidal. And here we just square that. Pardon? Yeah. Here we're just going to get, these are orthogonal to each other because this is toroidal and this is poloidal. So we just get the square of this times the square of this. Now what about the sign? This is always positive, and I squared is positive. So this term is always positive. Of course, because we're interpreting it as the toroidal magnetic field. D psi squared is positive because it's a poloidal one form, so the metric we're squaring with is Riemannian. But here we're squaring this toroidal one form with a Lorentzian metric, so this could be positive or negative. So the sign of this depends. And therefore, you can see that when you're going to violate potentially magnetic domination is when this form gets too big and becomes space-like. I mean, time-like, sorry. Let me interpret what that means about the configuration. I have to explain the meaning of omega and so forth. Meaning of all these things. Okay, so let's... So first, let me explain why is psi called the flux function. Remember, we're in stationary axis symmetry. So let's pick a poloidal point labeled by r and theta and sweep it around in a circle by the axial Killing field, and we generate a circle here. And we can span that with any surface we want and compute the magnetic flux over that surface. And that's what turns out to be, well, let's calculate it. So the field is d psi wedge d phi 2. I want to write that as a total derivative d of psi d phi 2. In other words, we could consider the vector potential for this field to be psi d phi 2. Obviously, I want to do this so I can use Stokes' theorem and now say that that's equal to the loop integral around the boundary of S. Now, psi is actually, well, okay, I'll go ahead and do it in two steps. Remember, psi is strictly poloidal. It's just a function of r and theta. So in this integral, r and theta are fixed because you're just generating the circle at fixed r and theta. So this is just a constant in the integral, and we're just integrating phi 2 around a closed loop, so we get 0, of course, except we don't, because this is a loop in the phi angle, and psi 2 has phi. So we actually get the jump in phi, which is 2 pi. So it's crucial here that we have that jump, and this is just equal to 2 pi psi. So psi up to a factor of 2 pi is nothing but the magnetic flux through this cap, a polar cap. So psi equals 1 over 2 pi times the flux through a cap. So it's called the flux function. But it's also called the stream function. Now, what about I? I called it I because it turns out to be current. Well, let's consider the same point, r theta, and consider the current flowing through this surface. Now, because I like to consider a current a three-form, instead of finding a current vector and integrating it, what I'm going to do is extend this surface S in the time direction by some interval of time and find out how much charge flows through it in that much time. So I'm going to integrate, and what is the current? The current is d star f. So I'd like to integrate over s cross an interval of time the current. That'll tell me how much charge flows through in that much time, and then I divide by delta t to get the standard definition of current. But again, I use Stokes' theorem. So I write this as d star f cross d delta t. So I get around the boundary now. Well, let's see. Wait a second. I don't have a boundary yet, do I? Right. So I'd like to use Stokes' theorem on a... No, I do have a boundary. I'm sorry. I take this disk. I extend it in time. And its boundary has a cap at the top, which is a copy of the disk at the late time, a cap at the bottom, and then the sides, which is where the current is flowing through. Now, the cap at the top and the cap at the bottom cancel because by stationarity of the solution and the orientations are opposite. So I don't get anything, so I only have flux through the side. So I just have to integrate the dual of f around the sides. Now, what are the sides? The sides are the boundary of s cross time. It's the circle cross time. So what this two-dimensional manifold has time in it, and it has the angle phi. So when I'm integrating the dual of f, I have to look and see where am I going to get forms that have non-zero contraction with the angle phi direction and the time, and that only comes from here. This could have a time and an angle, but this doesn't have time or angle. So this won't contribute to that integral, only this will. And this does in a trivial way. When I integrate phi, I just get 2 pi, because I'm going around the circle, and here I get the interval of time dt. So I just get I over 2 pi. I get, no, the 2 pi's cancel. So I just get I times delta t. So sure enough, I really does represent the rate at which charge is flowing through this cap. So we call that the polar current. Remember in the Michael monopole, the current is flowing in the North Pole and out the South Pole. So this would be an example of it. It usually is called the poloidal current, but we wanted to reserve that word for the current density flowing locally in the poloidal direction. So we called it, hoping it wouldn't cause confusion because it's almost the same word, the polar current. So we can look at the general form and identify then, here it is. This is the polar current. This is the magnetic flux function, and we just have to say, what is this eta? How do we interpret what that's telling us about the solution? To understand that, we basically need to know what omega is. This is the same as the omega we've been talking about. It's the angular velocity of field lines. Why is that? Well, let's ask what the what vector in the toroidal direction is in the kernel of f? In other words, how fast should you run around in the phi direction in order to stay on a field sheet at fixed radius? What you're really asking then is if I contract d by dt, let's see, what I need a place to write it. but I don't want to erase that, so. So suppose you ask, what angular velocity omega should I pick such that this dot f is 0? This will be what you mean by the angular velocity of the field lines, because if you move at that angular velocity at fixed radius and angle, you'll stay on the same field sheet. So we just plug this into there, and you see that what we actually get is d psi, or actually minus d psi, times dt plus omega d phi dotted into this eta. Eta was d phi minus omega f dt. And we just get from here an omega minus omega f. So for this to be 0, we should choose omega equal to omega f equals 0 when, and that in general depends on psi, which depends on where you are in the poloidal plane. So different field lines have different angular velocity or different field sheets. And there's a really nice interpretation then of that. That's the combination of the killing vectors that lies in the field sheet, d by dt plus omega field d by d phi. So we call that the field sheet killing vector and gave it a name chi. It's not a space-time killing vector in general because this is not a constant. But it is a symmetry of the field sheet, and or field sheets in general, and it lies in the kernel, so it's tangent to the field sheets. This is a field sheet killing vector, and it's orthogonal to eta. That's what we just showed there. We demanded this thing is eta, right? So if we were to raise the index of the eta 1 form and make it a vector, it's orthogonal to the field sheet killing vector. But the field sheet in the magnetic case is time-like, and that tells us that when eta is, in order for this to be magnetic, to be electrically dominated, we'd have to have this be negative. So eta would have to be time-like. Chi is perpendicular to eta, so chi would have to be space-like. But if chi is space-like, that's saying that the co-rotating four velocity is space-like. In order to stay on the field sheet, co-rotating at fixed radius, you have to go faster than light. So the condition for the field sheet to remain No, that's not true, because it goes one way and not the other way, because this term might still be big enough even if this is negative. It's just that if the field is electrically dominated, then this killing vector is space-like. That's what I was trying to say. Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you something without deriving it, because it would take too long to derive it, about energy and angular momentum flow. So suppose you have a curve in the poloidal plane, a segment of a curve, we'll call it P. It's a curve in poloidal space. Then we can generate a surface from it by rotating it around the axis. And then we can talk about how much, what's the rate at which energy and angular momentum are flowing through that surface in the solution. And there's a really nice formula for that that can be derived in terms of these functions. So there's a rate of flow of angular momentum and Killing energy. And this is simply the integral of the current, which is a function of psi, d psi, over this curve. Because we're assuming axisymmetry, this azimuthal direction is a trivial integral, and it just boils down to this. And the energy is almost the same, but there's a factor of omega f. I d psi. And again, this is also a function of psi. And I would really like to be able to derive those, but I think in the available time, we should pick and choose what we actually go into. And that probably shouldn't be one of the things, so hold on a sec. I think what I should show you is the stream equation. Any questions about this so far? I've been kind of blabbing for a long time without feedback. Let me just advertise that to get these formulas, so one thing you might think you should do is write the energy momentum tensor for the field, then figure out its flux through this surface and somehow get this formula. But everything's being done with forms. It's so pretty, so simple and clear. Could we just get this strictly with forms? And the answer is yes, in a beautiful way. That's explained in the paper. Instead of writing the energy momentum tensor, we should figure out what the another current is associated with each one of these symmetries. So for angular momentum is, what's the angular momentum another current? There's a beautiful derivation of it in terms of differential forms that just takes like two steps. And it's a very simple formula. And then using this form for the field two form, this form, we get these formulas very quickly. Same thing for the energy another current. So explained in Appendix E is, what is the another current in terms of a Lagrangian using differential forms language? I got that. I learned it from Bob Wald's paper on black hole entropy. And then apply it to electromagnetism, and you get a very simple result for these two another currents. And that's where this comes out of. In any case, the final result is extremely simple and useful. And it actually tells you something very important about the flow of energy and angular momentum in these solutions. People say that they flow along field lines, along poloidal field lines. What does that mean? So suppose our curve P actually is a level set of psi. So first of all, a poloidal field line is a curve in which d psi is zero, by definition. So it's a curve in the poloidal space. It's a curve in the r theta space with d psi equals zero. So it's a level set of psi, which starts to tell you why it's called a stream function, because it's a function whose level sets are the magnetic field lines. But it's not the real magnetic field lines, because the field lines actually have a toroidal component. So it's kind of projecting them into the poloidal subspace. So suppose this is one of them. Then when we do the integral, we just get zero manifestly, because there's no d psi. Same thing with energy. But that's telling you that there's no energy or angular momentum flowing across a poloidal field line, which is the same as saying it's always flowing along them. If it's going to change, it's only because you took a different one. So just in brief, this tells you that energy and angular momentum, and I'm going to put this in quotes, flow along poloidal field lines. That's why in the picture of the pulsar magnetosphere, I was saying that the energy flux is only coming from the open field lines. Because in the closed zone, if you even had energy and angular momentum flowing, it would be flowing out the top of the star and into the bottom of the star in a closed circuit. In fact, I think you can show that there is no such flow. At all in there, but I'm actually not sure, and I'm tired, so I better not try to say. Anyway, in any case, certainly the energy exiting the thing flows along the open field lines. Good. So now I think what we want to do is just the stream equation, or it's also called the, in the case of the pulsar equation, or the Radshchev-Franov equation has a whole bunch of names depending on who's naming it. But what it is the equation satisfied by this function psi. In fact, it's not just psi, but that's what gives it its name. It's going to be an equation that involves I. So we want to take this form of the field and impose the force-free condition on it. Remember, I haven't done that yet. This is true for any degenerate field. So we want to impose the force-free conditions and see what they tell us. One of them is almost trivial, which I'll show you in a second, and just corresponds to energy and angular momentum conservation. The other one's highly non-trivial, and it relates the second derivatives of psi to the functions I and omega. And that's really all we'll get to. And I think I probably don't even have time to derive it, but if I just explain what it is and what the starting point is, that's good.
So psi determines everything except for psi 2. And have you said anything about
No, sorry, it doesn't. Thank you for the question. It also doesn't determine the information in eta, and the non-trivial information in eta is this function omega f of psi.
No, but that's what I'm saying. So if you know psi, you know omega f?
No, but you don't know what function of psi this is.
It's an arbitrary function of
Okay. At this point, it's an arbitrary function of psi. And also, here, the reason I didn't talk about psi 2 is that I said I'd rather trade that information for this function I. Oh, I forgot to tell you. You are the greatest. Okay, good. Right. So at this point, I is not a function of psi. It's an arbitrary function of r and theta. If we impose the force-free condition, one of them, so the Euler equations, let's do that one because that's the really easy one to do. So what are our force-free equations? Remember back to the general formalism. We need the d phi 1 wedge, the current should be 0, and d phi 2 wedge, the current should be 0. Now, phi 1 is simply psi. So let's do that one first. And what's the current? It's d star f. And what's star f? It's this thing, right? So I just have to put that in there. Actually, minus. So remembering, So this term cannot contribute anything. The reason is, this is already a poloidal form. When we take d of that, that derivative is going to see r dependence and theta dependence. Nothing depends on phi or t. So this d acting on this form will only bring another poloidal form. At that point, we'll have a wedge product of two poloidal forms, but the poloidal subspace is only two-dimensional. So when I wedge it with this poloidal form, I'll get zero. So this term doesn't contribute anything. This term is almost trivial to evaluate because these guys are exact forms. So the answer is 1 over 2 pi d psi wedge di wedge dt wedge d phi. And the force-free equation is telling us that should vanish. Well, this sure as heck doesn't vanish. And this is a strictly poloidal two-form. So this can't vanish by virtue of wedging with that. So it can only vanish because d psi and di are proportional to each other. But di is nothing but I prime, the derivative of I with respect to psi, times d psi. Sorry, it has to be. I didn't say it correctly. Whoa, forget what I just said. Wipe that out. Roll the tape back. Okay. The only way this can vanish is if this poloidal two-form vanishes. That can only happen if d psi is zero, in which case the whole toroidal field is zero, and it's kind of a degenerate case. Or if di is proportional to d psi. But that's the same as saying that I can be written as a function of psi. Like I could use psi as a coordinate in my poloidal space. It's telling you that I is a function of that coordinate only. So this equals zero implies that I is strictly a function of psi. You'll get some poloidal form wedge, some toroidal form. Mm-hmm. But this is also a poloidal form.
That's a poloidal one form.
Right.
And d psi is a poloidal one form.
Right. So if I pick up another.
D star eta is a toroidal form.
No, d star eta is a half poloidal, half toroidal form. It's a two form, which is going to be partly.
Okay.
Toroidal and partly poloidal. In other words, the only thing that has non-zero derivatives is theta and r dependence. So when you take d of star eta, if you don't get zero, you're going to be picking up a poloidal one form. Yes. Yeah, it only depends. Everything only depends on r and theta. It doesn't, for that argument, it doesn't matter that it depends only through psi. Yeah, even if it's any poloidal function, the argument would still work.
Great.
So if you look at the meaning of this equation in terms of energy and angular momentum, it turns out this particular force-free equation is saying that there's no energy or angular momentum transfer in or out of the field. So it's conservation of energy and angular momentum only. And I point that out just because we emphasize that a huge amount, maybe too much in our paper, just because you can imagine a situation where you don't have force free in general, but you do have energy and angular momentum conserved in the field, like in one of these compressional current sheets. I think that is plausibly true. Force free is failing because of this static force in the theta direction or in the poloidal plane, but not because of any transfer event of angular momentum or energy. So in any case, that follows just from that. And now, so it all boils down now to this equation. having put this in. So assuming force-free or at least conservation of energy and angular momentum, we can write here I of psi. So we have two functions of psi, I, the current, the poloidal current, and omega, the angular velocity of the field lines, that are a priori not determined, and one function just of poloidal space, psi. So we plug all that into that equation and turn the crank, and what comes out in a few lines using differential forms. I'm extremely proud of this, deriving this equation without a single index and without and working in Kerr spacetime, completely general. Of course, it'd be nicer if we were the first people to ever derive the equation, but it's actually been known for 40 years. Actually, no, the first people to derive the curved space version were who? Let me think for a second. Was it Thorne and McDonald? McDonald and Thorne? Blandford and Znajek. They were the first ones. So it goes way back to the beginning. Okay, so what's the equation? It's a strange kind of equation. It's the following. Here's the nicest way that we found to write it. Yes, finally at the end, we're going to, well, you want me to write? I can do it without indices. Okay, no, now you got me. No. D of eta squared star d psi. Okay, is that enough? No, honestly, I think it's more convenient not to write this one in terms of forms, even though we did derive it that way. The last step, we translated it. Okay, eta squared nabla psi. Then the standard notation here is to put a prime to indicate derivative with respect to the psi argument of this thing. Then we just have the inner product of dt and eta. D psi squared. And then we have minus I times I prime over 4 pi squared times the toroidal determinant equals 0. And I should say that since psi only depends on the poloidal coordinates, this derivative only sees that. Nothing depends on anything else, so we could replace this space-time covariant derivative by a poloidal covariant derivative, or even by a, as McDonald and Thorne did, by a spatial, three-dimensional spatial derivative. And the form is a little bit different for each of those. Let me just actually write the poloidal one . No, maybe I won't. It doesn't matter. It's in the paper. So you can re-express it in terms of that with some determinants in a simple way. So let's write the name. This is called Rad-Shafranov equation. Sometimes, although this name is also applied in MHD settings, which involve a kind of generalization of this equation, or the stream equation, or like I said, for a pulsar, the pulsar equation. So what kind of an equation is it? It's an elliptic equation for psi. If omega f and I were given as functions of psi, if somebody just told you what they are or you made a guess, then this would just be some second order elliptic equation for psi. But they're not given. So how do you solve it? One way is people just guess values of these and then try to solve it.
Isn't there any other equation that you can impose to get information about omega?
You can impose, no, I don't think so. Now, let me try to explain what's so confusing to me about this equation. It's nature. It looks like there's a huge amount of freedom, completely two free functions, but you've only got one equation, and then you have this other function. You have two functions of psi, though, so there's kind of a self-consistency that's very confusing and implicit. It turns out, in practice, if you impose boundary conditions, often, or maybe usually it seems, it just turns out that numerically searching for solutions, you find one solution with those boundary conditions. But I think there are exceptional cases known where there's more than one solution with a given set of boundary conditions. You might say, well, could I add some conditions at the boundary? I think there are situations where everything you'd reasonably put at the boundary is fixed, and still there are multiple solutions. But sort of generically, from what I get from the literature, it's sort of like an elliptic equation in that solutions are kind of determined maybe up to discrete choices by boundary conditions.
Do you know if people have analyzed that equation in mathematical terms as a maximum principle or something to see where you actually should expect a unique solution or not?
You're speaking a language I don't know. But I'd like to know. I don't know how you know something like that. Say it again. There is an action. I don't know if this helps. You can get this from an action principle.
No, and also in they're analyzing uniqueness solutions of P, of elliptic P, then this thing called the maximum principle or the Yamabe types of equations where you actually take an elliptic equation and you find out where you should get a unique solution or not.
But isn't that in the setting where these functions omega and I would actually be given functions, some nonlinear given function?
It could be a function of the unknown as well, right? It could be nonlinear term.
Yeah, given functions of the unknown.
Yeah.
Right. But so there's something really different here. It's not a given function of the unknown. It's part of what you're solving for is that function of psi.
Right, but then if you do the analysis, you might end up giving you some constraints on those things to get a unique solution.
Maybe. I would be very happy to see somebody. As far as I know, nobody who likes to understand. I've never seen an analysis from the mathematical point of view of what should you expect. People just jump on the equation and start solving it somehow or other. Now, actually, the way they do it is very interesting. And I should make the point before we stop about one of the key things about solving it has to do with what happens when eta squared goes to zero. Because just imagine there is some surface where eta squared goes to zero, and I'll say that's the light surface. You know, eta squared in flat space, eta squared is just d phi squared plus omega squared dt squared. So for a fixed omega, and the magnitude of d phi squared is 1 over r squared. So in flat space, eta squared flat is just equal to 1 over r squared minus omega squared times 1. So that vanishes when r omega is 1, which is the light cylinder, which is also where this becomes a null vector, which is also where the field sheet killing vector becomes null, which is a kind of horizon for the field sheet. It's a place where causal propagation on the field sheet can only go in one direction. So it's just like a horizon on the field sheet. And there's a whole interesting story about it. It's a horizon for particle motion and for Alphane waves, which are perturbations of these solutions. In any case, this can happen, obviously, in flat space. In a case of a black hole, for example, it turns out it happens. There's a distorted version of this light cylinder that's curved. But there's also an inner light surface near the horizon. Here it's happening because the field lines are rotating too fast for the co-moving observer to be time-like. And near the horizon, the field lines are rotating too slow for the co-moving observer to be time-like. So you have two surfaces like this, and they're crucial for the purpose of this equation, because when that's zero, it means that the second derivative term vanishes. So that's called a singular point of the equation, and the character of the equation changes. And it's not a generic solution will have a singularity at such a point, because you can imagine if you were solving an equation like del squared psi plus or equals some other stuff, which involves first derivatives of psi stuff and whatever else. Well, obviously, if you're solving for the second derivative, you're going to be dividing by eta, but you're dividing by zero. So generally, if you approach that surface, you'll generate a singularity at it, integrating from one side. So it turns out that, as I understand it, in effect, you get an extra boundary condition at every such light surface. They're called light surfaces to generalize light cylinder, because it's in general not cylindrical and it's just some other surface. So people that solve this equation in the presence of boundary conditions end up, in fact, this is a better way to say this, tell the story. It was only fairly recently, I think in 1999, Kontopoulos, Kazanis, and do you know the third author? Kalapatharkos. Anyway, three authors are actually managed to solve numerically as a static problem this equation for pulsar magnetosphere. In 99, the equation was written down 30 years earlier. And it's really amazing that nobody had done it. I guess partly because computers, you know, weren't fast, but they were 20 years before that. I don't really know. Part of the problem was this technicality. So it turns out to actually deal with this singularity where eta goes to zero, you have to do something a bit clever and generate solutions from your boundary data on the horizon. Let's say on the surface, yeah. In the case of a pulsar, it works this way. You have a boundary condition at infinity, a boundary condition on the surface of the pulsar, and you have this light cylinder. And you integrate this way with some free sort of functions, because there's not a unique way to integrate off because you don't know these functions in the solution. Similarly, you integrate this way with some free functions. And then you require that, you know, you have smoothness here, which almost always you don't have. And somehow forcing it to be smooth resolves the ambiguity in these unknown functions, omega and I. Actually, I should say, I'm overstating it. In the pulsar case, what they would typically do is set omega to a constant ab initio. I was thinking of the black hole case. This is great. So I can actually explain this. So in the pulsar case, omega is fixed. It's the angular velocity of the star. So we don't have to worry about that. We have one function, but we don't know it. So we start off with something from both sides and find that we can only make it smooth if there's a definite current that's determined. And I think there's a physical interpretation of that in terms of potential drop. Basically, look at the form of F. Psi is like the electrostat. It's like an electric potential because in eta, we have a dt term. Actually, I have an omega dt. But when omega is constant, it's just like having dt. So we have a d psi wedge dt. That describes an electric field because it has a dt factor. And psi is it's like a potential for that electric field. The field is the gradient of that psi. So you know that if you knew psi between two points, you would know the potential difference. And Ohm's law tells you that if you know the potential difference and you know the resistance, then you get the current. Now here, the problem is we don't know the current. You could say, yeah, but do we know the resistance or the reactance or something? I'm not sure what the right concept is. And the answer is, yeah, we kind of do. This is not, there's no dissipation here. This is just going to be a solution for energy and current just sort of streaming out into empty space. So the impedance of the empty space is sort of fixed once you just fix the boundary condition at infinity. So in some sense that I don't understand in detail, you sort of do know the resistance. And since psi by itself would determine the potential drop, it's plausible that it determines the current, and that therefore the current really isn't an independent function, and there would only be one self-consistent way to solve for psi and I. So that's my rationale of understanding why it might be that you get sort of unique solutions once you fix boundary conditions. Then in the black hole case.
But here, I mean, you, by fiat, decided that the omega f would be a constant. If you didn't do that, you'd have a lot more freedom.
Absolutely. I would lose it, absolutely. But then I would need some other, if I had a boundary condition, let's see, is that enough? Well, let me show you how it works in the black hole case, where I don't have omega as a constant. And then maybe you'll be able to infer the general statement, which I don't know. So let's replace this by a black hole. Then we don't have any angular velocity. We don't know what it should be a priori. So this is the horizon. So now we have two unknown functions. But as I just said a second ago, we get an inner light surface. So in other words, eta squared is zero at two places in the black hole magnetosphere. So we get an extra one of these crazy matching conditions. And the same authors just a few years ago figured out how to basically upgrade their method to do a matching here and a matching here, and put boundary conditions here and just a regularity condition here and get a solution. Now, there's another way to get these solutions that's much more simple if you have a good computer and you can know how to use it, which I don't, but Luis does. You just set it up as a time-dependent problem. Because the force-free equations, remember, in the case of magnetic domination, they are a well-posed initial value problem. So you can just set up kind of somewhat random initial conditions that satisfies your boundary conditions you want to impose, and then just run the evolution and put in the code something that is not force-free, that lets the solution dissipate and settle down to a force-free solution. Tell me if I'm saying anything wrong here. And then you just find, asymptotically in time, it gets to some solution, which you can read out of the computer. And people have compared these, which also are calculated with a computer, but in a static way, to these time-dependent evolutions, and I guess Luis should tell us, actually, to what extent they match. I don't know.
Yeah,
I think they match.
For the black hole on the pulsar.
Although the new standard pulsar magnetosphere that came out last year, I don't know if anybody's ever seen that come out of a time-dependent, but surely somebody should try, I mean. The thing, though, is they might have imposed an unphysical boundary condition at the current sheet, and therefore
that you could then turn into how you're pruning your field there, maybe that would be that.
But the problem is, and it might be that you could, presumably you could somehow or other relax to their solution, but that wouldn't mean it was physically the right condition at the current sheet. So I don't know. So
crazy eigenvalue problem, but you're not solving for eigenvalues, you're solving for function valued eigenvalues.
You're solving for the equation. You're solving for what equation you were solving.
Is this, sorry, that's the complete system there. There's no other supplementary equations like that. That's it from there.
Right. We completely, that's it. So it all boils down to one crazy equation. I don't know of any proofs of that kind of statement. And I think, but in practice, it seems to be, at least up to sometimes I believe there are different classes of solutions you can find with the same, like different sectors, kind of. So
the statement is that if you didn't fix the two functions properly, you would get singularity with light sources.
Right. Sorry?
Like a constant sign should be a solution with constant I and constant of the F. I just want to do something with a Taylor series for both I and the F, and you've just got coefficients in the Taylor series to fix.
The way Michael actually found his solution, crazy enough, was he actually was dealing with this equation in flat space, more or less, and he just fixed omega to be a constant. And he assumed a form of I of psi. He just kind of guessed a form. I'm not sure how he guessed it. And then he sort of was surprised he got an exact solution. He was able to get it. So it was a completely different route than we came to it from. Okay, so I think I shouldn't keep lecturing about, you know, we shouldn't continue the course. Like I said at the beginning, but I'd be super happy to talk to anybody and everybody about the material and more what's in our paper and try to answer some of these open questions. So.